This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Spiritual Ground of Education. This is Lecture 2, entitled The Perception of Soul and Spirit, given on August 17, 1922. I have been informed that something I spoke of yesterday was found difficult to understand, in particular my use of the terms spiritual and spiritual cognition. Consequently, I will depart somewhat from what I had planned, and instead speak about these terms, spirit, in German Geist, and spiritual life, in German spirituelles Leben. This will lead us somewhat away from the subject of teaching and education, but from what I hear it seems we will better understand one another during the next few days if I explain the concept of spirit, soul, and body. During the next few days I will find an opportunity to say what I had intended to speak of today. Now, a lecture such as today's will require that I speak in a theoretical way, in terms of ideas and concepts. I ask you to consent to this for today, and in the days that follow things will be better, and I will not torment you cruelly with ideas and concepts, but try to please you with concrete facts. The words spirit and spiritual, from my present point of view and general outlook, are usually deeply misunderstood. When the word spirit is used, people assume it's similar to a word like intellect or the English word mind. But what I mean here is something very different. On the one hand, my meaning must not be confused with the way certain mystical, fanatical, or superstitious sects and movements use the word spirits and spiritual. On the other hand, it is quite distinct from what is meant by intellect or mind. We need to understand in a direct, concrete, and real way what is at work in small children up to the time of the change of teeth. This activity is not directly perceptible, but we see it expressed in a child's nature, which might even appear primitive to us, and thus we can say that this is spirit and soul. Nowhere in our observations of the human being and nature do we encounter spirit and soul so directly as when we contemplate the manifestations of life in a small child. Here, as I said yesterday, spiritual forces and soul essences are active in the formation of the brain and in the shaping of the whole organism. What we see are manifestations of life in a child. We perceive these with our senses. But it is spirit and soul that work through from behind the veil of sense-perceptible things, so we can apprehend them here as nowhere else in life, unless we have accomplished an inner soul development. Thus we must say that spirit is really unknown to direct, ordinary perception. At most, soul can manifest in ordinary perception, but we must feel and sense it through the percept. If I may use an image to indicate what is meant, not to explain it, I would say that when we speak, our speech comes from words, sounds made up of consonants and vowels. Observe the great difference between consonants and vowels in speech. Consonants round off a sound, give it angularity, make it into a breath sound or a wave sound, according to how we form the sound with one organ or another, with lips or teeth. Vowels arise in a very different way. They arise while guiding the breath stream through the vocal organs in a certain way. By means of vowels, we do not give contour, but build the substance of a sound. Vowels provide the substance or content, and consonants mold and sculpt the substance provided by the vowels. And now, using the words spirit and soul, in the sense we are giving them here, we can say that spirit is in the consonants of speech, and soul is in the vowels. A footnote for more on the subject, see Rudolf Steiner titled The Genius of Language, and also titled Curative Eurythmy. End of footnote. When children first begin to say ah, they are filled with a kind of wonder and marvel, a soul phenomenon. This phenomenon of soul is directly present to us. It flows out in ah. When children express the sound eh, they exhibit a slight antipathy of soul and withdraw in response to something. Eh, expresses something antipathetic in the soul. Wonder is expressed by ah, antipathy by eh. Vowels reveal soul phenomenon. When I form any kind of consonant, I surround and shape the vowel sound. When a child says mama, a double gesture, it shows a need to reach out to the child's mother for help. Footnote, the eurythmic gesture M is implied, end of footnote. By itself, ah would express the child's feeling for the mother. M expresses that the child would like what the child would like the mother to do. Mama contains the whole relationship between child and mother in both spirit and soul. Thus we hear language spoken, we hear its meaning, but we fail to notice the way spirit and soul are hidden in language. True, we are occasionally aware of this in speech, but we do not notice it in the whole human being. We see only the outer form of a person, but soul and spirit are within, just as they are within speech. But we no longer notice this. There was a time in past ages, however, when people did notice this. They did not say, quote, in the beginning was the spirit, which would have been too abstract, but, quote, in the beginning was the word. People still had a living sense of how spirit is carried on the waves of speech. It is this spirit and its nature that we mean when using the word spiritual. It is not revealed by intellect, nor by what we call mind. Mind and spirit are distinct from each other. They differ as much as my person differs from the reflection I see in a mirror. When I hold a mirror and look at myself, my reflection is in the mirror. The reflection moves exactly as I do, and it looks like me, but it is not me. It differs from me because it is an image, whereas I am a reality. Spirit is the reality of hidden depths. Intellect contains only an image of spirit. Mind is a reflected image of spirit. Mind can reveal the activity of spirit, and it can make the motions of spirit, but mind is passive. If someone hits me, mind can reflect it. Mind cannot itself give a blow. Spirit is activity. It is always doing, always creative. Spirit is the essence of productivity, generation itself. Mind, as intellect, is a copy or reflection and passivity itself, the thing within us that enables us, as adults, to understand the world. If intellect or mind were active, we would be unable to comprehend the world. Mind must be passive, so that the world can be understood through it. If mind were active, it would continually alter and encroach upon the world. Mind is the passive image of spirit. Thus we look from the reflection to the person when we seek reality. Similarly, when we seek the reality of spirit and soul, we must move from the unproductive and passive to the productive and active. People have tried to do this throughout all ages of human development. And today I want to speak to you about one method of this search, so we can agree on the meaning of spirit and soul in what I have to say. Usually, and as adult human beings, we perceive spirit only in its reflections as intellect, mind, or reason. We apprehend the soul only in its expressions. We are closer to soul than we are to spirit, but we do not perceive the full inner activity of even the soul. We perceive revelations of the soul, and we perceive spirit only as a reflection. A reflection holds nothing of the reality, but we do perceive revelations of the soul. What we know as feeling, our experiences of likes and dislikes, of desire and passion, belongs to the soul. But we do not perceive the nature of soul within us. What is this soul within? Perhaps I can indicate the nature of soul if I distinguish between our experience and the events that take place within us so that we are able to experience. When we walk over soft ground, our footprints remain. Now suppose a man comes along and discovers our footprints. Will he say that forces in the earth have shaped the earth to form these impressions? No one would say such a thing. Rather, anyone would say, someone has walked here. Materialists say that they find impressions in the brain, just as the earth retains impressions after I have walked on it. But they will say that there are forces in the brain, and these make the impressions. This is not true. The soul makes the impressions, just as I make them on the ground. And it is only because those imprints are there that I can perceive the soul. I perceive a sensation in the soul. At first the soul is hidden, but it has left its imprints in my body. If I make a very hard dent, it causes me pain. Perhaps I do not immediately see what I have done, since that happened behind me. But even when I do see what I have done, I experience the pain. But even when I do not see what I have done, I experience the pain. Similarly, the soul leaves an impression in my body, whereas the soul itself remains hidden. I perceive the effect as passions, sympathy, and so on. I perceive the effect of the soul's activity in the manifestation. Consequently, with spirit, we have an image. With soul, we have an expression. We are closer to soul, but keep in mind that we must look for spirit or soul more deeply than mind, intellect, or reason. This may help in understanding spirit and soul. And to make the concept of spirit and soul even clearer, let me turn to an historical aspect. And please do not misunderstand me today, as too often happens. I do this simply for the sake of clarification, not with any intention of maintaining that to reach spirit and soul we must do as the ancients did. Nevertheless, the present method of attaining spirit and soul will be easier to understand if we turn to history. To attain spirit in the 20th century, it is impossible to proceed as people did hundreds or thousands of years ago in ancient India. Nor can we do as was done before the mystery of Golgotha. Footnote: the mystery of Golgotha is a phrase that Steiner uses to indicate the events surrounding the life of Christ, or the last 3 years of Jesus' life. End of footnote. We live within the development of Christianity, but it will help us understand spirit and soul if we look back to this older way and see, for example, how the path to soul and spirit was completely different for those who were spiritual and those who were merely intellectual. What do we do today when, in keeping with the general consciousness of our age, we want to become clear about ourselves? We reflect by using our intellect. And what do we do when we want to become clear about nature? We experiment and bring our intellect to bear upon our experiments. Intellectual activity is everywhere. In ancient times, people tried to reach spirit and soul in a very different way. I will give two examples from the many I could cite. Aspirants tried to reach spirit and soul in the very ancient East, for instance, through the method of so-called yoga. Today the mention of yoga produces a feeling of slight horror in many people, since only its later methods are known to history, methods based on human egotism, which seek power in the outer world. The more ancient paths the people took toward the spirit were the older yogic methods, which can be discovered today only through spiritual science, not through conventional science. Those methods were based on their instinctive sense that people could not know spirit through mere reflection or thinking. They had to do something that would reveal activity in themselves far more than mere reflection could do. Thinking continued, even when they stood aside from the world as mere observers, but it could not bring about any perceptible inner change. Yogis looked for a far more real process within themselves when they wanted to study spirit. Suppose we ask, in terms of current physiological knowledge, what happens when we use our intellect? An event takes place in our nervous system and brain, as well as in other parts of our organism, that are connected with the brain through the nervous system. But this event in the nerves could never happen if an activity far more perceptible were not intermingled with the processes of our brain. Unceasingly, From birth until death we breathe in, retain our breath, and breathe out. When we breathe in, the breath moves through our whole organism. The thrust of the breath moves through the spinal cord into the brain. We breathe not only with our lungs, but also with our brain. But this means that the brain is in constant motion. As we breathe in, hold the breath, and breathe out, the breath lives and billows within the brain. This goes on continuously, although we are unaware of it today. A yogi would have said that such events in a human being must become conscious. Thus, yogis did not breathe unconsciously in the usual way. They breathed in abnormal ways. They breathed in differently, held the breath differently, and breathed out differently. Through this method, they became conscious of the breathing process, and they experienced with full awareness something that takes place unconsciously for us, because they conceived it and then experienced it. Thus, yogis came to experience how breath unites in the brain with the material process behind thinking and intellectual activity. They looked into this union between thinking and breathing, and they finally experienced the way thought, which for us is an abstract thing, pervades the whole body, carried on the tide of breath. Consequently, thought was not limited to the brain, the lungs, or the heart. Thought went into one's very fingertips. From real experience of the breath pulsing through them, yogis learned how spirit creates within a human being through the medium of breath. Quote, "And God breathed living breath into the human being, who thus became soul." Close quote. Not only did God breathe this breath in the beginning, but God breathes continuously wherever breathing takes place. And in the breathing process, not in intellectual process, we become soul. We experience our own being when we feel thought pulsing throughout the body on the tide of breath. Spirit was no longer separated as something intellectual and abstract. Hence, spirit could be sensed and felt throughout the whole body. One's humanity could be felt as a creation of the gods. They had active spirit. In intellectuality, spirit is passive, not active. Nowadays, because of our different makeup, we cannot imitate that yoga process, nor would it be proper to do so. What was the goal for yogis? Their goal was to experience how the thinking process is connected with the breathing process. The breath, as their mode of cognition, allowed them to experience their humanity. Yogis united thought more intimately with human nature as a whole than we do today. But our human progress is based on the fact that we have liberated thought and made it far more intellectual than it was when yoga flourished. The discoveries of people like Copernicus, Galileo, Faraday, and Darwin could never have occurred within a system of thought like that of the ancient Indian yogis. Such achievements required a type of thinking that was reduced to reflection, image, and intellectuality. Our whole civilization is based on the fact that we are so different from those who developed yogic philosophy. People often misunderstand my descriptions of these things. They think that I want to take people back to the philosophy of yoga. This is certainly not the case. On the contrary, I wish to approach matters as they were in the age of Copernicus, Galileo, and Faraday. We must recognize that Western civilization achieved its greatness through intellectuality. But our feeling must also be different from that of the ancient Indians, and it must be different, too, from the feeling of those who now practice yoga. Today we must proceed in a way that is quite different from that of ancient Indians. It must be a more spiritual way. Because it must be more spiritual, and because people do not care much for spirit today, it follows that people do not care for the new methods. It is easy, or at least it seems easy, to practice yoga breathing today in an effort to enter the world of spirit. But this is no longer the means whereby people should enter spiritual realms. Rather, modern people must first experience the world of appearance, the unreal image of things, which we can perceive by mere intellectualism. Today, at some point, we must experience the suffering that goes along with the realization that as long as one is occupied solely with intellectual activity and observation, one lives in emptiness and mere images, remote from reality. What I am saying seems insignificant, but it is great in terms of inner experience. Once we have the experience that all intellectual thinking is unreal, a mere image, then we experience in our souls something that the body would experience as fainting. We experience fainting in the soul in relation to reality. In fact, knowledge does not begin when you can say, "I think, therefore I can reflect on all things." Rather, knowledge begins when you can say, "Although I think about everything with my image thinking, I am only a weak, impotent being." Yogis looked for their humanity in the breath. Today we must lose our humanity and become weak and faint through our intellectuality. Today we should be able to say, "I must not go inward through the breathing process as did the yogis. I must move outward, looking at every flower, every animal, and every human being, and live in the outer environment." In my book titled How to Know Higher Worlds, I described how to do this, how to look at more than just the outer plant by participating in all its processes, so that thinking is taken out of its image nature to participate in the life of the outer world. Or we can sink into a plant until we feel gravity going down through the roots into the earth and the formative forces unfolding above. We participate in the unfolding flower and fruit of a plant, diving right into the external world. Thus we are taken up by the external world. We awaken as though from a trance. And now we no longer receive abstract thoughts, but imaginations. We get pictures, but a materialistic view would not recognize such images as knowledge. Knowledge, it is said, involves abstract logical concepts. This is true, but how if the world is not meant to be comprehended through abstract logical concepts? If the world is a work of art, we must understand it artistically, not logically. Here, logic is only a means of discipline. We should not understand anything about the world through logic. Consequently, we must enter the objects themselves. Whereas yoga went inward, we must go outward and endeavor in this way to unite with all things. Thus we can in fact attain the same thing, only in a more soulful and spiritual way. By permeating reality with the discoveries of mere intellectual ideas, we get a renewed sense of how spirit works creatively in us. And from this, we must begin to feel the reality working in children. It is not the so-called mind in us that is active. In a small child, this would not be creative. This notion would only lead us astray. Rather, in a small child, the active principle is just what we come to know in the creative way described. It is this that forms the second teeth, according to the first, concluding in the seventh year. Nevertheless, we are not called on to do this. A few people in the world can develop such higher knowledge. Everyone else needs only sound judgment and observation. Everything these few discover, others can recognize through sound judgment and sound observation. Not everyone, for example, can observe the transits of Venus. These are visible far too rarely, and astronomers can observe them occasionally when they are visible. But does this mean that it would be illogical to speak of the transits of Venus simply because one had not seen them? After all, the object and method of observation can be understood. It is the same thing with the spiritual world. Simply because of egotism today, people want to do everything themselves. One can argue that as teachers, we cannot immediately become clairvoyant. We cannot train in such methods. How can we manage teaching if we are first confronted with this complicated method of reaching spirit? There is another way of making spiritual things fruitful and using them, however. Again, I will illustrate this with an example. Imagine I am teaching a 9 or 10-year-old girl. I want to tell her about the immortality of the human soul. If I go into philosophic dissertations, however charming, this child will make nothing of it at her age. She will remain untouched by my little lecture. But if I say to her, "Dear, see how the butterfly comes out of the chrysalis? There you have an image that you can apply to people. Look at the human body. It is like a butterfly's cocoon. The butterfly flies out of the chrysalis, and in the same way, after death, the soul flies out of the body. Only the butterfly is visible, and the soul is invisible." Now, I merely suggest this image here. For a child, I would elaborate. Where this has been put in practice, I have found two things. When a teacher describes this image to a child, the child does not understand it. The teacher might convey a charming image, but nothing reaches the soul, and the true object is missed. Another teacher might describe this picture, perhaps in the very same words, and the child will have a real insight as the whole image enters the soul. Where is the difference? The first teacher is very smart and ingenious, infinitely clever. So the thought arises that a truly intelligent person would not consider the chrysalis and butterfly to be a valid image. We can get away with this only because the child is foolish. One invents a clever image for a silly child. We have a clever teacher and a foolish child. And one who invents a picture for a foolish child will not be understood. You can depend on it. The teacher will not be understood. Now another teacher believes in this picture. Here a different thought arises, that the divine goodness of the world has itself placed this image into nature so that we may better understand immortality. It is not something we have to invent. Rather, we discover the image. The creative spirit of nature makes this image for us so that we may see immortality in its image. God himself painted this picture in nature. If one believes in this image, then a child will believe in it. The child gets all that is needed simply because one is not thinking. I am clever, the child is foolish. Rather, one thinks of the child as having brought intelligent spirit into the world through birth. The child is intelligent. The child's spirit is not yet awakened. If we are unable to awaken it, it is we who are foolish, not the child. Once the thought arises in us that children possess hidden intelligence, and that we have manifested foolishness, and once we realize that it is our duty to become intelligent by learning from children, then we can make a real impression with our instruction. In the first case, we have a teacher who thinks of himself or herself as clever, an example of how the intellect works. In the second case, we see an example how spirit works. We see something spiritual and inwardly alive and reaching for the nature of things. This teacher can be effective even without clairvoyant vision of the spirit. Spirit is active there. You are working in active spirit when you believe in your own pictures. If you do not believe in your image but make up an image only through intelligence and intellectuality, you remain outside reality with your intellect and mind with only a mirror image. Mirror images do not act. They are merely passive. Spirit is productive and creative, and it is essential to become creative and to be at home in creating if we wish to be active in spirit. Thus, through the soul's own work, and by working our way into imagination itself, we approach and enter gradually into spirit. First, however, we need to experience the importance of the intellect. Then we enter the spiritual. This must be the conclusion for today, since it is too late to continue. Tomorrow I will describe another way to spirit and then continue with our theme. Yesterday's request made it necessary to explain these concepts more exactly. I hope you will accept this as necessary for a proper understanding. Soon, after I have explained this other path, the ascetic path, in contrast to the yoga path, we will be finished with this grim pastime, and then we will be able to go into actual methods of education. The end of Lecture 2.